You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so excited to be here with you in my first show for 2022. I hope you all had a happy and healthy new year and managed to stay safe with the virus and such. But I am really excited to be here with you. My guest today is going to be Ed Maltby. He is the executive director of the Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance, and he'll be joining us in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways that you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So first, I just wanted to share with everyone a wonderful tradition that I have for New Year's. Every New Year's for the past 40 years, and I can't believe this was our 40th anniversary of going to Vermont to our friend's house. They live in rural Vermont, just surrounded by nature. And, you know, they have all the outdoor sports one could want. They have a pond where you can go ice skating and cross-country skiing right outside their door. And the best part, though, is the cooking and eating and sitting down for shared meals together and watching our family grow. When we started, I was the only one, actually one other person had a child too, but our kids were really little. I think my oldest was, I guess, two or three. And since then, we have all gotten married and had kids, and many of our kids have had kids. And it's just such a pleasure to watch the generations unfolding in front of our eyes. And our kids have grown up together and they know each other so well. And it's just beautiful. And New Year's Eve night, we shared around the table, you know, our favorite memories. And it's just something our kids can look back on for their life and something we certainly cherish. And so I just want to encourage people, you know, if there's ways that you can start traditions that you can do each year, it's just so valuable to give that that rhythm to your life and have a way that you start the new year each year. It can be small. It doesn't have to be a whole weekend away. It can be just, you know, doing what we did about going around the table and sharing. But it was just really beautiful, and I wanted to share that with all of you. I also want to encourage all of you listening to register for the Northeast Organic Farming Association New York's annual winter conference, which is coming up. It starts January 18th and goes for 5 days. And it's just a wonderful opportunity to gather with hundreds of other farmers and lovers of organic to learn new skills, to support each other, to celebrate community, and to learn from one another. And there's a whole huge schedule, and you can sign up, and there's also a sliding scale. You know, I think we've passed the scholarship date, but there still is sliding scale, and so you can fill out a form there too if the cost is going to keep you away. We don't want anyone to not come because of the cost. So check out the link. I have a link on my website, or you can just go to NOFA New York's website, and you will find out information about that. But it's really just such a wonderful thing. Of course, unfortunately, we're doing it again virtual this year. We did it last year virtually, and we had a really hard time deciding whether we should do it virtual again. But I think we made the right call. We had to decide in the summer. And with the spike of COVID right now, it was a good thing, I think, because I don't think many people would have wanted to come in person. So it is virtual, but there's breakout sessions and there's ways that you still can feel connected to the community. So do check that out. I wanted to ask all of you to support the Farm System Reform Act. And to do that, you need to let your senators and representatives know that you think the Farm System Reform Act that Senator Cory Booker and Representative Ro Khanna have introduced into Congress. The Farm System Reform Act would place an immediate moratorium on the construction of any new factory farm or expanding any existing factory farm, and also phasing them out by 2040. And I know 2040 seems like a far time away, but all these things take time. And getting rid of CAFOs, which are confined animal feeding operations, which are really what factory farms are, is really something we really have to do. I mean, it puts our public at risk. It increases corporate control over our food supply. It compromises our health and safety and pollutes very often marginalized communities. So it's just bad for everyone. It's bad for the planet. It's bad for your bodies. And we need to raise food that's better, and we need to support the farmers that are doing that. And I'll be talking to Ed about that in our interview in just a little bit. So stay tuned for that. But the Farm System Reform Act is really something that you want to support and you want to let your Congress people know. And then I also wrote about mindful eating. The New York Times had a great article about that. And I've, you know, over the years have always struggled with my weight. But for the last five, I really haven't struggled. I have stopped dieting forever. And I just try to be more mindful about what I'm eating. And not only what I'm eating, but how I'm eating it, the time I'm taking, slow food, you know, which is, I'm a big proponent of as the chapter of our Long Island North Shore. Slow food, you know, really brings that consciousness to the table as well. So if you don't know about the slow food organizations, check that out. But bringing mindfulness to the table, slowing down, enjoying the food you're eating, taking the time to prep your food, and then sharing it with other people really helps helps you bring the mindfulness to the table and eat more consciously. And by doing that, you'll eat less. You'll think about the food you're eating and how it's making you feel. So often when people are depressed or alone, whatever, we crave these comfort foods that very often are not good for our bodies. And you have to change your mindset so that the comfort food that you're craving is really more food that actually makes you feel good. And you can know when you're eating it, you're doing something nice to your body, as opposed to grabbing the ice cream and the, you know, the pastina or whatever it is that might be your comfort food. So check out the New York Times article. I think you will enjoy it. And I want to now share with you this week's recipe, which is a vegetable paella that I made with tofu. And it's a really quick meal. Very often paella, people can think, can take a long time. This is just a vegetable paella. I was able to come home and make, put it together really fast on a weekday night. So this is what you want to have on hand. You need some saffron. All paella starts with some really good saffron. And you're going to let that soak in a cup of boiling water and just put that to the side. Then you need 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 1 medium onion, 2 carrots cut into chunks, 4 mushrooms sliced up, 1/2 cake of sprouted organic tofu. That's just what I had, but of course any tofu would work. 1 teaspoon of minced garlic, 1 teaspoon of minced ginger, a bunch of collard greens, 1 head of broccoli, 1 poblano pepper, 2 cups of cooked basmati rice, 1 teaspoon salt, 2 tablespoons tamari, 1 teaspoon of herbs de Provence, 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley. Now, instead of herbs de Provence, you can also put in paprika, which I know is a different flavor, but it will give you a different feel. Traditional paellas usually have paprika in it. I was looking for something a little bit more herby and savory, so I went for the herbs de Provence. So you can dissolve the teaspoon of saffron threads in the cup of boiling water and set that aside. Heat the oil over medium heat in a large, heavy cast iron or paella pan. Add the onions and cook that for a little while until the onions are translucent. Then add the mushrooms, the garlic, and ginger and cook that until the mushrooms start to brown. Add the carrots and the tofu and let that cook for about 5 minutes until the tofu starts to get a golden crust on the edges. Cut the collard greens into thin ribbons and add that to the pan. Stir in the saffron with its soaking water and let the collard greens just start to wilt. Then add the broccoli and the poblano pepper and let them cook down with the broth. Add the tamari, the salt, and the herbs de Provence. Add the cooked rice and just cover it and let that simmer for about 5 minutes. Remove from the heat and garnish it with some parsley, and that's it. It's just really delicious. You know, I like having leftover rice in my refrigerator. So whenever I make rice, I always make double portion or even triple portion. And if I make a triple portion, I put one portion's worth in the freezer so that I can also pull that out on a weekday night if I don't have time to make rice. So thinking of those ways of saving time really help you put dinner on the table during the week. And they're just really great little tricks to get you to eat well and have everything on hand that you need. Anyway, now it is my pleasure to introduce all of you to Ed Maltby. Ed is a producer with over 45 years experiencing managing conventional and organic dairy, beef, sheep, and vegetable enterprises on a variety of farms, both in Europe and the United States. An important focus of his work has been assisting regional farms to cooperatively market their products into mainstream markets, ranging from direct marketing lambs and organic produce, establishing a cooperative of dairy farmers who direct market their own brand of milk in Western Massachusetts. And he led the development of a 12,000 member community-based consumer cooperative in Northampton, Mass. Since 2005, Ed has worked as executive director of the Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance, which is an organic family farm member organization dedicated to preserving organic integrity and a sustainable pay price for farmers. He is a founding member of the Organic Farmers Association that provides a national voice for organic family farms. Ed served on the USDA Dairy Industry Advisory Committee, advising Secretary of Agriculture on dairy policy and on the executive committee of the National Organic Coalition. In 2006, when one of the last two remaining USDA slaughterhouses in Massachusetts was destroyed by a fire, Ed worked with the family-owned Adams Farm Slaughterhouse to develop a creative and sustainable financing package for construction in order to rebuild as a 16,000 square foot USDA certified slaughterhouse that is animal welfare certified, halal, kosher, and organically certified. The plant opened in November 2008, and in March 2009, he became the general manager. And, you know, with full disclosure, all of you know that I've been vegan for the last 2 years, vegetarian for or pescatarian for 40 before that. But I am also a big promoter that if you are going to eat meat, you want to eat the kind of meat that Ed really helps make happen. So, Ed, welcome.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. So that my listeners can learn about the Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance and also about the struggle that organic dairy farmers are facing right now, especially here in the Northeast, when they have so much competition from CAFO-type organic farms that are out in the West. So maybe you can start first by just telling us a little bit more about what the Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance does and what makes them different from some of the other organic advocacy groups.
Yeah, well, NODPA, Northeast Organic Dairy Producers Alliance, was started in 2001 when, surprisingly enough, Horizon Organic decided to reduce the pay price of Northeast Organic Dairy Producers. Back then, there was not that many, but it actually brought the group of dairy farmers together. And what the organization does is to promote the interests for a fair pay price, what some people now call a living wage for farmers, so that the farms that produce the high quality organic food can also benefit from it, not only in lifestyle, but in able to purchase other foods they don't produce that are organic. And so the pay price has been the central part of what the organization has advocated for, as well as the integrity of the organic seal. Without the integrity of the organic seal, then the extra cost that's involved with farming organically, and especially farming organically with dairy, cannot be passed on to the farmers to have a sustainable and fair pay price. So we need high integrity. We need to honour the trust of that consumers place in the organic standards. And consumers pay more for a product they believe is produced by organic dairy farmers that follow all the intent and the regulation of organic, the National Organic Program, which is run by USDA. So, you know, NODPA has become one of the leading advocacy groups for organic farmers in the country by being part of coalitions based in Washington, D.C. The National Organic Coalition is the primary one that can represent and talk directly to USDA and our congressional representatives. But NODPA is not dominated by any one buyer, not dominated by any one subsection of organic dairy producers. All our members encompass those farms that those organic farms that do feed grain, those that are grass-fed, those that are seasonal, those that have made deliberate choices on how to market themselves. But the only requirement to be a member of NODPA is that you're an organic dairy farmer in good standing.
Mm-hmm. And can you talk about, you know, how do you work on regulatory and pay price issues? And what's really different between, you know, the organic producers versus conventional dairy? You know, I know very often on the packaging, they, you know, even on the organic milk, they require you to say, you know, there's no difference between, you know, organic milk or regular milk. But those of us that know there is. So can you talk a little bit about the difference?
And the difference is very important, especially now as we face such a an environmental crisis. You know, one of the basics of organics is that it emphasizes soil health. And what we as representing organic dairy farmers and any organic farmer, that's what we promote. And so there's a, if consumers buy organic, and that's represented by the National Organic Program seal on every package. So if you don't see the seal there, and it's got sort of organic wording in the name or the brand, then you know it's not organic certified. And organic certification is a third party certification. So it covers the auditing of the product, that it's following the regulations from the time it leaves the field, from being in the field grown, and follows it through the whole process of perhaps processing or packaging and delivering to the marketplace. So that organic seal is the only one in the market at this point that is federally enforced and has the independent auditing at every single process. Much as we'd like to trust some of the other brands out there that say our farmers sign an agreement they won't use this, or an agreement they won't use that, and we agree to follow these practices, then if you're going to invest your consumer dollars in a product, you want to know that that's not just a verbal agreement or a written agreement that can easily be broken. So that's where the benefit of the organic seal comes in. And we freely admit that there are challenges as the organic seal has grown. Then there, you know, the old saying that where there's money, there'll be corruption. And that has, of course, happened to some extent. And part of our process of advocating is to ensure that the regulations are enforced to the letter of the regulation. And that's very important when you come down to the ability to enforce standards in a court of law. And with some of these large international consolidated corporations that have seen the benefit in the marketplace of earning extra money, extra return, extra margin, then they will freely admit that they won't do anything unless there's a law court that stops them. And, you know, they will go through every step to ensure that they have that ability to circumvent some regulations by following the letter of the law. So we emphasize, you know, we did a landmark. We were part of a group of farmers and consumers and advocacy groups that promoted the access to pasture. And the access to pasture was something that we as farmers asked for. It ensured that the organic dairy cows would actually go out to pasture. On the NOP regulations, when they were first promoted, it was that organic dairy cows had to have access to pasture. Now, for you and me, access to pasture means they go outside and they graze and they come back in. To some of the large CAFOs that wanted to take advantage of the high standards of organic and the premium in the marketplace, then access to pasture was having a door at the end of the barn that right. faced out onto some pasture or some green stuff. It might not necessarily
be
pasture.
They could go out if they wanted, right?
Yes. And they would first fill them up with a lot of feed and say, hey, go out. And cows aren't that stupid. So they would feed and then look outside and say, no, we're not traveling out there. So this rule was, some would say, was over clarification. But in retrospect, and this was 10 years ago now, there were some areas that we actually missed that the large corporations have found a way around. And so that attention to detail that only farmers and practitioners can agree on, because we know how to do it right. And we also know that where the loopholes are, and we can see them in day-to-day operations. And so that's why we need a very active organic voice in Washington, D.C. as they make new regulations, and to ensure that the regulations reflect both the integrity of the organic standards plus practical farming requirements. So we don't ask organic dairy farmers to follow practices that don't enhance the soil, that don't benefit the environment, that don't benefit the health and welfare of organic dairy cows. And unlike conventional animals, then organic dairy cows are allowed to build their own immunity by that we take some of the stress out of the farming system. We don't expect very high yielding animals. We don't push the animals with lots of high protein feed that produces a lot of milk in the first 3 years, and then find out that the animals can't really walk because they don't have the holistic approach to their health. So it's, you know, obviously within the standards, then the feed that organic animals have has no pesticides, herbicides, and it comes from organic sources at all times, which is important because it builds the fertility of the soil, it builds the natural immune system. But also it ensures that the organic dairy cows, you know, as you described in your recipe earlier on, it's what you eat that makes you healthy. And it's very similar for animals. And if you can get that natural immune system, you can feed it, feed the animals, care for the animals. And that takes extra time. In some cases, it takes extra money. not for the veterinarian services, which most organic dairy farmers have in an infrequent use of veterinary services because they don't need them. They take preventive care with some vaccines, but most of the time you have that natural immunity that is built up.
So what's the difference then about organic milk that says grass-fed milk? One would think that all organic milk would be grass-fed if they're going out to pasture. Is there a certain time limit or how much grass-fed they're eating versus versus, you know, grain-fed, you know, versus organic feed?
And basically grass-fed should mean, and in some cases does mean, that they aren't fed any outside protein. Obviously, in the winter, they have conserved forage. During the summer, they graze. And then there are certain amendments you need to ensure a healthy diet. That is the true nature of the grass-fed. But we have a number of different certifications for grass-fed as well. Some have the authenticity of good, well-managed brands. Organic Valley and Maple Hill Creamery have some very good standards they adhere to. Horizon Organic, which is part of Danone Empire, has a grass-fed that says that the animals should be out grazing for 200 and something days. And, you know, that when you bring that sort of criteria in, you know, should or can instead of will, then you have to be careful about exactly what brand we're looking at when we purchase grass-fed and how that brand operates and who governs that brand. You know, Organic Valley is owned by organic farmers, and like any cooperative, there are it's not that easy to manage a national cooperative that has billions of dollars in sales, but there is that essence there that the farmers do control, eventually do control the from the board of directors down, and that grass-fed criteria for Organic Valley means that the animals are out on pasture for as many as long as is viable. They are fed other cereals and grains towards the end of season, the beginning of the season, to supplement their diet, but they're not fed any concentrated grain. That's not necessarily an easy thing to do because, you know, you have to maintain a healthy animal, and that, you know, at different times of year, you might need to feed more protein or you might need to feed more fiber to maintain different health conditions when they're pregnant or when they you want them to conceive. But it comes down to a choice of the breed of animal and the type of farming you do. And it is like anything in agriculture, it looks easy from the outside. It's just when you get into actually doing it, you realize that some of these herds that do well as grass-fed have been perfecting the genetics of the herd for the last 50, 60 years.
Can you taste the difference between milk that's grass-fed versus milk that's grain-fed?
It depends a lot on how that milk is processed. Unfortunately, a lot of organic milk these days is ultra pasteurized, which means it's taken to a very high temperature very quickly, and that prolongs the shelf life. Some of the more smaller operations only take the milk up to a lower temperature, enough to pasteurize it and to ensure it follows the criteria for the health regulations, but doing it that way maintains, in my opinion, more of the taste. You know, it's difficult for me to offer opinion.
But my listeners should really look for just pasteurized and try to avoid the ultra pasteurized milk,
if possible. And that is sometimes possible with the the smaller, more local brands. And, you know, the large corporations and Organic Valley, which have a wide circulation area, wide distribution area, then they go for the longer life because that's what the regional buyers require. So they can store more milk in regional warehouses. And so instead of having a shelf life of, say, 28 days, you've got a shelf life of 3-4 months. And in my opinion, that takes away the taste. I'm not a very good judge of taste because I was spoilt by being able to take milk straight from the bulk tank and drink it that way, and therefore that is the real taste of milk. For a majority of people, not necessarily these days, but you sometimes get a burnt taste with the high pasteurized, the high temp pasteurization. And, you know, the nutrients of grass-fed, there's still a lot of research going into that about whether that is more beneficial on different levels. But I think I always come back to, you know, what are you, how are you feeding yourself? What are you putting into your body? And how does that affect the social and environmental climate that you live in? And with organic systems capture and store more carbon in the soil. They also release fewer greenhouse gases. They have high standards for animal welfare. What we are missing within the organic standards is high standards of welfare for organic farmers and farm workers, because that's not part of the organic standards. But from the point of view of having a product that is good for you, good for the environment, then as long as you've got that organic seal on it, then that guarantees that product follows those requirements. And then everything else, you know, if you can get grass-fed, that's better. If you can get local grass-fed, then that's ideal. And, you know, I don't necessarily promote raw milk sales because that has implications all over the country. But if you can find a good producer for raw milk and your body can accept that raw milk, then that obviously has the highest nutrient value.
Sure. So what is the current state of our organic milk supply? And, you know, has the alternative milk market really impacted the organic milk farmers?
The current state is that we are in somewhat of a surplus in the country as a whole. When you look at demand on the retail level, and approximately 85% of organic milk is sold at the retail level in packaged product. Now that doesn't really tell the whole story, because you now have a situation where the organic dairy market nationally is dominated by two or three national and international players. You've got Danone, which is the third largest dairy company in the world. You've got Lactalis, which is the second largest dairy company in the world. And they play a prominent role in branded product in the US, branded organic product. Organic Valley, as a cooperative, has a better management system, a better ownership system, but they are still very much a national cooperative that has to survive and build their whole business for all their members across the country. So, you know, coming back to a more regional analysis of the situation, then in the Northeast, we have a very strong market, as you know, for organic products. And, you know, we're not just concentrated in Boston and New York, but we have highly educated consumers with value the choice. You know, they support farmers markets, they support private local programs, and they should have the opportunity to have product that is grown and processed within the Northeast, so they can guarantee that they are supporting Northeast farmers and they are supporting the environment they live in. And in the last 5 years, 6 years, we've seen the infrastructure of the dairy industry be consolidated. Much the same as we've seen in the meatpacking industry. Mm-hmm. We've seen the closure or the mothballing of small local plants. We've seen the establishment of larger plants that do have the ultra-pasteurization ability. And they are located most of them now are in Western New York because of the benefits of having those manufacturing industries in that part of the state, but also they have better access to larger volumes of milk coming out of the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And basically, and one of the real truths of organic farming and farming in the Northeast is it costs more. We have higher costs of labor, higher cost of land, higher cost of business input, and in order to be successful as a dairy farm in the Northeast, then you have to get a higher pay price than you would perhaps in the Midwest, where you can have large dairies that have the economies of scale. And what has happened is that companies like Danone, who have the Horizon brand amongst their organic products, they've made the decision that their bottom line is how cheaply they can produce a product and how much of a margin they can get for their international company. And so they've decided they're not willing to pay the Northeast pay price. They want to access milk from larger operations, CAFOs in the Midwest and in the western part of New York and adjoining states. And so they made the decision to leave the Northeast. And that wasn't just we'll slowly move out of the area, we'll work with farmers, we'll work with the states, we'll work with the communities to ensure that the impact on not only farms, but on the rural communities is mitigated. They just sent out letters to farmers saying, you know, in the end, it was 89 farmers saying, okay, you've got a year. And then
right, we're cutting dumped. You off. Uh-huh.
And find another buyer. And in a good market, you can sometimes find another buyer. In a market that doesn't have any competition, that was virtually impossible. And they knew it, and they knew exactly what their actions were going to do to the farmers. They promote that they're a B Corp, which has a triple bottom line approach to their actions. They promote one world, one healthy, that's not a good quote, but it's perhaps my cynical brain there working. You know, they haven't followed that. They attract consumers because they want to be viewed as a good company. And what they've done to not only the farmers, but to the rural communities is dramatically bad.
Yes. Yes. I know when I first joined the board of NOFA, I remember we were just having a conversation. I had mentioned how I don't buy any Horizon brands because, you know, I know Horizon has not been a stand-up organic organization. And one of our board members said, well, that means you're not buying my milk. And I was like, what do you mean? And that was the first time I realized that Horizon actually was buying from local farmers and putting all the milk together. I didn't really realize that. And now with Horizon or Dannon pulling out of the Northeast and just going to the West, you know, and hearing about that they're getting their milk more from CAFO type farms. How do CAFO type farms, which are the confined organic operations, or not confined animal feeding operations, how do they qualify as organic?
That's a very quick, good question, which we're continuously asking of certifiers and the National Organic Program. And, you know, from my point of view and other farmers' point of view, you can walk onto a farm and you can see exactly whether these animals go out to graze. You know, you look for lanes where animals go, you look for watering spots, you look for shade, you look for all that criteria. And it should be a no-brainer, if you like, for some of the inspectors from certification agencies to go out to the farm. And if they've got the right skills and they've got the right qualifications, they can see very easily that even if the records of these farms, and we're talking about 5,000 to 10,000 cow herds, accurately reflect that they meet the minimum standards of 120 days on pasture. And if they meet the minimum standards for animal welfare, that these farms aren't truly organic. And it's, you know, our argument with the certification agencies is you've got to employ people that can go into those situations and analyze the data and are experienced enough to analyze that data and come up with the right questions. And most of these large CAFOs do have their own veterinary services. They have their own highly qualified consultants that devise the rations, and they have, you know, they go into the minute detail of the regulations and ensure that they do follow them. So it's a question of how the inspectors and then the certifiers, when they analyze reports from inspectors, and then the National Organic Program, when they go in to audit the certification agencies, it's how they analyze that situation and really truly ensure that they are following the standards, that all the animals are organic from the last third of gestation, that they do spend the required amount of time out on pasture, not on pasture that is got barely enough to eat, but on real grass that is growing and is regrowing, and you have rotational grazing. And that, you know, if we don't do that, then we lose the trust of consumers. And once we've lost the trust of consumers, then it's a downhill path, not for these big CAFOs, because they, you know, if organic isn't so good, then they might call it regenerative organic, or they might call it Dannon regenerative organic, or they might, you know, start branding it differently or add.
Well, we're already seeing that, right? We're already seeing these add-on labels like the Real Organic Project, or the Non-GMO Project, or Regenerative Agriculture. You know, so we're already seeing add-on labels, because I think a lot of people are questioning the trust of certifiers. I know as a board member for NOFA, there's talk about how, you know, NOFA certifiers really do a good job. They know what they're doing. You can trust that they, you know, that if it's a NOFA certification, you can trust that that's really an organic product. But all certifiers are not created equal. Just like I always say, all broccoli's not created equal. You know, it depends on the certifier. How can people find out what certifiers you can really trust, and what certifiers you can't trust?
And again, that given the way that the organic market is now consolidated, and given the delivery systems we have across the country, and we've seen just how weak they are in the last few months, but everything doesn't, you know, all you need on the package is the organic seal. You don't need to have on the package which certifier has it. And some certifiers do put their names on it, others don't. And that's where it comes down to the local and regional identity. And as you say, you have NOFA New York, which is highly regarded, NOFA Vermont, Maine Organic Farmers. And, you know, they have been following the standards right from the start. They have been, they have farmer boards, they have farmer consumers input, and they have those internal controls within the certification agency that says, no, our aim here is to maintain integrity. Our aim isn't necessarily to build a highly successful certification business. Whereas other certifiers look, you know, especially when some of these large organic dairies, they cost a certification maybe in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the economic impact on the certification agency of them giving a non-compliance or a default is could be dramatic and could cause the operations to move to a different certifier. And what we're, it is not the consumer's job to do that level of investigation. It is the National Organic Program's job to ensure that there is equivalency across all certifiers. And we have been advocating for many years that National Organic Program adopts higher standards, has more people involved, adopts international standards, and has international certifications of their process. We now have a NOP that has, I think, 72 employees. In 2005, it had 8. So we are slowly catching up to this massive organic market and trying to impose retrospectively equality and standards. And I think it comes back to the old buy local message, know your farmer, know who you're purchasing from, and you know, encourage your farmer to be organically certified so that, you know, it is more paperwork, but it does maintain that integrity. And, you know, it's up to all of us, farmers, consumers, advocates, to maintain that integrity and ensure that the people involved in the organic industry, and it is a massive industry now, are predominantly motivated by the integrity to have a soil-based organic system.
Mm-hmm. And I know you keep saying soil-based, and I think that's really great because, you know, there's all the conversation about hydroponics and how hydroponics can be organic. And, you know, those that are really committed to organic know organics about the soil, and hydroponics doesn't have soil. So that's a real problem. Yeah. I don't want to get off track, get into that, but, you know, I appreciate that you keep talking about the soil because that is really the foundation of what makes something organic. And, you know, like when I say all organic broccolis aren't created equal, even that, you know, it's like, how good is the soil? And that really, really makes a difference. So I know we were talking about pay price and getting the price of milk up. And, you know, with the minimum wage being raised, and I think most of us would agree that we want farm workers to be able to make a living wage. Yet at the same time, we know farmers, organic farmers are not making a lot of money, and that the increase in hourly wage is really impacting them. Can we talk a little bit about, you know, how your organization is managing that? I mean, you know, how do you get around that? I mean, we want farm workers to make, you know, a living wage and get overtime and get a sick day off and, you know, all those kind of things. And yet those extra costs are really impacting the small family farmers who really, you know, are barely squeezing out a living wage for themselves. Can you talk a little bit about that?
And yes, and that's, you know, why I always try and promote not just animal welfare, but farmer welfare.
Right.
You know, it's what happens when the pay price drops. Now, the pay price in organic is decided by the large corporation, basically. And all the large brands follow that, follow their lead. And it's not based on the cost of production. It's not based on the geographic location. It's not based on the type of product that whether it's grass-fed or not grass-fed. It's based on the decision of brands on supply and demand. And what has happened to the pay price in the last 4 years is that it is below the cost of production in the Northeast. It is not below the cost of production for large CAFOs in the West and the Midwest. So effectively, the large CAFOs and operations that can produce cheap milk are being promoted by these brands. And what is suffering is the small to mid-sized operations, which, similar to the conventional market, they dominate in numbers, but not in volume. So the number of small operations vastly exceeds the number of large CAFOs, but the CAFOs produce the more milk and they produce it cheaper. And they have their own, perhaps their own processing plants on site. And so, you know, part of that advocacy for a reasonable pay price is integrity of the standards. And the other part is the relationship with the consumers and the, you know, with the latest action by Danone, we had a great response from all the organic advocacy groups in the Northeast and nationally and from consumers. And we delivered a petition of 16,000 names to Danone asking them to take responsibility for their actions. And that's something that NODPA and other groups can do. Organic farmers...
Did they come back and make a different offer?
They came back and said they would extend the cancellation of the contracts by another 6 months. And they offered a pitifully small amount as a...
Stipend?
probably less than a stipend, but to cover some of the costs that these farms have had because of the transition. So we're going to go back to them again. You know, the farmers can't do it themselves because they're contractually forbidden to go public with their conditions to their contract. So, you know, if they do go public with some of their grievances, then in the past, farmers have been cut off, their contracts have been ended. So the power of the large organizations, the large national brands over individual farms is immense. You know, you have to have your milk picked up every other day or every day. And if you've got no one to pick it up, you've got no living. And so the individual farmer has no leverage. What NODPA and other organizations do, and NODPA does it very specifically for organic dairy, the other organizations in the Northeast do it in general for organics and for farmers, but we specifically do it for dairy. And we can bring to bear the concerns and the support of all those that want a high quality product from a regional location, that want farmers to be paid. They pay more for their product, and assume that the farmer is getting a good return. And so we want to promote that, yes, the product is good, it's high quality, these farms do a wonderful job in the Northeast, but they're not getting paid enough. And so we need the consumers to support with their buying power. And sometimes that's a question of, not to buy Danone product. Buy Horizon Milk, perhaps, because you know there's still a few in Western New York that do supply it. But look at the other products and how can we affect them there down bottom line in the market? Because Danone have said very plainly, we are looking at the bottom line, we're not looking at anything else. And so if we can advocate and work with consumers to affect the total bottom line, then we can perhaps have some effect. Over the years we've been doing this, then we've recognized that it's small steps, it's patience, it's education, it's everything takes three times as long because we're dealing with the federal government. And then we have to deal with large corporations that dominate the federal government. With this action by Danon, it's brought to a head the fact that there is not the infrastructure in the Northeast to have a regional supply of milk. And so we're now advocating, as we have in the past, but now with a great deal more support, that we need small to mid-size processing plants that can genuinely say that they process local milk, and that local milk can get to the market, and the consumer can make the choice with their dollars about what they purchase. And, you know, even with Organic Valley, which is a high-class brand, a lot of that milk comes from outside the region simply because it's cheaper for them to do it that way.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, when it comes to people ask me, okay, what as consumers can we do?
That was going to be my next question. You just took it away from me. What can my listeners do to help? I mean, whether it's, sign petitions, petition, don't buy Danon products, but what else can they do? Because I think they want to help.
And I think that, if you're lucky enough to have a regional brand that is still processed regionally, buy that. If you do know the farmers that are participating, buy that. In the scale of good quality, then obviously Organic Valley is way up there. Organic Valley Milk goes into the Stonyfield retail brand, and so again, that's a good brand to purchase.
Now you also said Organic Valley is now buying also milk sometimes from the Midwest. Are they getting it from other CAFO type Midwest operations, or are they select enough that they're getting it only from smaller farmers that are doing it right?
And that's a question that I am continuously asking them to ensure that there is that level of investigation. They are faced with the same challenges of managing a large scale business and the economies of scale. I don't have that information because that information is not public. There is no accountability, unlike the conventional market. It is very difficult to trace where milk comes from. In looking at the options for consumers, and that's why we do need a regional brand that we can say is regional and can be identified as regional, that is owned by regional farmers and doesn't look to be any bigger than the region. It doesn't want to be a national brand. It doesn't want to be a multi-regional brand. It wants to be a Northeast region brand. And that's what we need consumers to support. And
consumers have to know that they're going to pay more for that, right? Because
to a certain extent, they might need to pay slightly more. But if you look at the statistics, then conventional dairy farmers get around 60% of the retail price. Organic farmers get around 30% of the retail price. So if we look and see where those different margins are going, and we have an organization that is owned by regional dairy farmers and managed not by them, but managed under the instruction of them and governance of them, then we can see how that distribution of margin can be directly fed back to the owners of the milk. The equation isn't simple.
Ed, know what? We are just about out of time. I totally lost track. I could talk to you for another hour easily.
Could you
do me a favor? Send me anything that I can share with my audience. Any petitions that you have or anything like that I could encourage my followers to sign on to, and I'm sure they will. And I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been awesome talking to you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and NODPA, www.nodpa.com. And thank you for all your support and for your listeners in buying organic.
Thank you. And everyone out there, have a great rest of the week. Make my paella. I think you'll love it. It's really easy. And I will see you all again next week. Have a wonderful rest of the week. Bye for now.